Good day, and welcome to the Fagery Drinker Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you, operator, and hello, everybody. I know these are difficult times. I hope that you and your family and your colleagues are all safe and healthy and that notwithstanding some of the bumps in the road that we're experiencing, that you're doing well and that we'll be coming back from this shortly. With that said, let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to do today. The speakers on today's Beltway are myself, and I'm in the Los Angeles office of Fagery Drinker. I'm a partner in the Benefits and Executive Compensation Group and head of what's called the ERISA Financial Services Team, which means we do a lot of work for service providers, investment advisors, broker-dealers, record keepers, third-party administrators, banks and trust companies, and so on. So that involves fiduciary and prohibited transaction issues to a large degree. With me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad is a partner in the firm as well, also in the same practice group, but significantly he's a former assistant secretary of the Employee Benefits Security Administration at the Department of Labor. So he's had experiences that will give us valuable insights. Also with us is Sandy Granum. Sandy's the head of our FINRA team, and she has offices in Florham Park, New Jersey, and New York, and needless to say, is a partner in the firm. And then Jim Lundy, who is also a partner in the firm. Jim's in the Chicago office, so we've got you covered nationally here. Jim spent a number of years with the SEC in both examinations and enforcement, and has incredibly experience to get some incredible insights, both in private practice and with the government. So we're loaded for bear. Also with us is Jim Dolan, who's the Vice President of Retirement Strategies at Natixis Investment Managers. Natixis has been great in sponsoring these programs. They've allowed us and you to get together on days like today and to talk about current events inside the Beltway. So, Jim, let me turn it over to you for a minute. Let me say thank you first and then turn it over to you for a minute.
But thanks so much. Certainly do appreciate the partnership. This is certainly a great call. We're grateful that we're able to bring all your perspective via this Inside the Beltway call. And I do want to thank everyone who's been able to join us today and call in and take some time out of their day, which I'm sure is different than the days were, you know, certainly several months ago. And I do hope that all your family are safe and healthy, as Fred mentioned. For those of you who aren't familiar with Natixis, we are a global investment platform with independent affiliated investment managers with over 200 investment strategies worldwide. We focus on active investment management. In retirement business, I'm very much responsible for our focus on sustainable investing and providing sustainable investments to planned participants and employees who are saving for retirement. So again, thanks so much for joining us on the call today. And Fred, I'll turn it back to you.
Jim, thank you very much. Let me do two more housekeeping things, and then we'll get to the substance. Number one, the session is being recorded. So if you find it really interesting and want to listen to it again, you can. Or if you want to recommend it to your colleagues, you'll be able to do that as well. It will be posted in a matter of a few days on our website, fagerydrinker.com, and there's a tab there called Insights and Events. Having said that, if you didn't write that down, don't worry about it, because everybody who registered will get an email with a link once it's posted. So that's an even easier way to access it. The second housekeeping thing is that we're going to do Q&A at the end. Our goal is to leave about 10 minutes at the end to answer questions. We've had a number of pre-submitted questions, which you all can always do when you register, and we're going to try to make sure to address those as well as any open line questions. But until then, the lines will be closed. The operator will announce when we open them. Okay, with that out of the way, let's jump into our topics for today. The first one is going to be about the CARES Act. We're going to talk about the four relief provisions for participants and IRA owners in the CARES Act. And Brad and I are going to do some back and forth on it. I'm going to introduce the topic, lay some of the groundwork, and then turn it over to Brad to talk about the kinds of questions we're getting and any additional comments he may have. Let's start with the definition, though, of a qualified individual. Well, why does that matter? What's a qualified individual? Three of the provisions of the four that we'll talk about require that to be eligible to get the benefit, you have to be a qualified individual. I'm going to pretty much give you the definition right from the CARES Act, and here it is. It's a person who is diagnosed with the virus or with coronavirus disease. That's the COVID-19 that you've heard so much about. But by a test approved by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. So they actually have to be tested by an approved test, and they have to test positive. Or, there's three criteria. Or, alternatively, whose spouse or dependent was diagnosed in the same way with the virus or the disease. Or, third, who experienced, and this is the more open one, the more liberal one, if you will, who experiences adverse financial consequences as a result of being quarantined, furloughed, laid off, having work hours reduced, being unable to work due to lack of child care due to the virus or disease, or an owner of a business having to close or reduce hours. So anyway, in other words, if somebody is financially impacted. So conversationally, people are just saying who experienced adverse financial consequences. You have to be in one of those three categories to be a qualified individual. And in that case, the two loan provisions and the special coronavirus-related distribution provision are available to you. If you don't fall in those categories, they aren't. On the other hand, the fourth category, required minimum distribution suspension or waiver, you don't have to be. That's available to anybody. Okay, so that's the difference. That's what you have to satisfy. But who do you prove it to? Well, you don't really prove it to anybody, except unless you get audited by the IRS several years down the line, because in terms of qualifying for it vis-a-vis a retirement plan, you can self-certify. So that what I just read to you could be put on a piece of paper or read over a call center phone line, and the person could, the participant could say, I hereby self-certify. I agree that one of those three categories applies to me. In that case, they've self-certified and they're eligible. So the only person they might ever have to prove that to is if they get audited somewhere in the next few years and the IRS says, hey, we want you to show us that self-certification was accurate. Okay, so first category is loans. There is a loan provision that says, the traditional loan provision says you can borrow 50% of your vested account balance up to $50,000. And that continues to apply to any individual if the plan has a loan provision. But if the plan wants, if the fiduciaries decide, and technically if the plan sponsor decides, because it's a settlor or plan design issue, the plan can be amended to say 100% of your vested account balance up to $100,000 for a loan. In that case, the plan sponsor does not need to actually amend the plan now. Plan sponsor can make that decision administratively. The plan has to be amended no later than the end of the plan year beginning in 2022. But of course, you got to let your record keeper know so that the provision can be administered. In fact, many record keepers, maybe most or all record keepers, are sending correspondence or memos or emails to plan sponsors saying, if you don't let us know by a certain date, which in most cases is common cause, we will deem you to have elected either to use this provision as well as the other two corona or all four of these provisions, to not use it. In other words, they're deeming plan sponsors into making elections. If you're a plan sponsor on this call and you haven't heard about this yet, it may have happened and you just didn't realize it. If you're an advisor, then you should be talking with your plan sponsors about whether they defaulted or not, and should they have. because there's a need to get some clarity here. While the decision is a settled law decision, the implementation is a fiduciary act, and that requires that the fiduciaries pay attention to it. So, Brad, let me turn to you before I go to the next one. By the way, this provision is only effective until September 22 of this year. It goes away. It's a pretty short-term provision. Brad, let me turn it over to you just to see if you want to add anything here, or should I move on to the extended payment period?
Well, yeah, I think the main thing to add here is to remind everyone that there's two different things going on. There's one, are participants eligible for this benefit if it's offered? But two, there's the question of, is it going to be offered? And that's a plan, as Fred said, that's a settlor decision, not a fiduciary decision. And what we've been seeing with our plan clients is that there's pretty wide disparity, actually. There is not a uniform movement to one answer. It really is an individualized thing that plans are looking at. So where we've seen plans who, you know, their employees are still operating. They're in an industry that's going, you know, great guns, like trucking or the grocery stores or something of that nature, where everyone's working. A lot of those plans have not elected to adopt the loan or the other provisions on the grounds that they haven't reduced hours, their employees haven't had reductions in work that would necessitate sort of breaking the glass on getting into the retirement savings, because as we all, you know, say often, retirement savings isn't an emergency savings. It's supposed to be for retirement. So there's a lot of people, a lot of plans looking at this saying we don't want to do it. The flip side, of course, is there's others who are looking at it saying, no, our folks need this. We're not working. This is something that we definitely need to adopt. And that's really been a very different decision. I think Plan Sponsor Magazine did a survey, and about two-thirds of plans were adopting the coronavirus distributions that Fred's about to talk about. A little less than half were doing the loans. And I think that's something we ought to come back to, Fred, after you talk about the distribution, is the differences between them and what plans might want to think about in adopting one versus the other versus both.
That's great. Let's do that. Okay, Brad, I'm going to move then to how payments can be suspended on loans that are due. These could be existing loans, or it could be new loans under the special coronavirus provision, or even new loans under a regular provision if the plan permits participant loans. Loan repayments due in 2020 can be suspended for 1 year. So, for example, a literal reading of the rule says if a payment was due on March 31st and wasn't made, it's not due till March 31st, 2021. I'm talking literal. There are some disagreements about what it means. Literally, a payment due on June 30th of this year isn't due until June 30, 2021, and so on. And then the overall five-year term for the repayment of the loan can be extended, well, approximately 9 months and 4 days. A period between March 27 and December 31 of this year can be tacked on to the end of the loan term as it exists. But there's some disagreement here. For example, what happens when the January 1, 2021 loan payment becomes due? Do they make that before they make the delayed March payment, or do you reamortize the whole loan? The bottom line is we will get some guidance from the IRS this year. I mean, I just can't imagine they won't give us guidance before the end of the year. But, Brad, what are you hearing about that?
Yeah, there's some real, particularly in the loan provisions, there's some real questions about how to apply what's in the statute. For example, there's a question of, is it mandatory for a plan to permit someone who's not a COVID loan, someone who's just got a regular loan that's been ongoing before all this, is the plan required to let them not make a repayment for the rest of the year if the participant wants to do so, or is that something the plan gets to decide? A literal reading of the statute suggests that it is not optional, that it's mandatory. But if you look at guidance the IRS put out back for Hurricane Katrina, which had almost identical loan suspension language, the IRS had reached the conclusion that it was optional for plans to follow that. So there's several pretty significant implementation issues that we don't have guidance on, and we're having to make some judgment calls. So if you look at your record keepers, and this goes back to something Fred said earlier, you know, advisors and plans should both be aware of this, record keepers are applying some of these rules rules differently from record keeper to record keeper because there hasn't been guidance. So you really do need to reach out to your record keepers, make sure you understand what's happening. I guess I'd put it, to put it very simply, I'd put it this way. There's what the law permits us to do, there's what plans actually want to do, and there's what their record keepers can do when it comes to these provisions. And those aren't all three the same thing. So there really needs to be some communication, and it needs to really should have already occurred. If it hasn't, it needs to occur in the near future to deal with these provisions however the plan decides to.
Yeah, that's a great point about the three touch points there, Brad, and how all three have to be in sync or it's just not doable. Keep in mind that this provision, as I said at the beginning, the three we're talking about right now, these two and the coronavirus-related distribution that I'm going to get to in a second, you have to be a qualified individual, and you don't have to amend the plan until 2022, so you can make the plan year beginning in 2022, so you can make an administrative decision now and implement it now, but then document it later. Okay. Special distribution.
Which, by the way, just to echo that point, Fred, that is a huge advantage for us because almost inevitably there are going to be mistakes and problems, and the ability to write a retroactive plan amendment that exactly matches what actually happened is going to be a big advantage to prevent problems from technically ever having occurred. So you have time to make adjustments, make changes, do things a little differently, and then retroactively fix it all, and that's a big advantage.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, I mean, I could be a little bit upset with Congress for leaving some big holes that I assume they think the DOL and the IRS will fix with guidance. But I have to give them credit. They have made this flexible, and it needs to be because people are working from home. It's hard to communicate, yada, yada. So, I mean, to their credit, they did some really good things here. Moving on to the special distributions, they are literally called coronavirus-related distributions. So the acronym is CRDs. So if you hear that, if you hear somebody referring to CRDs, that's what we're talking about right now. Again, you can self-certify. Doesn't have to be amended to a plan year beginning in 2022. This is permissive. One thing it is not, though, it is not a hardship withdrawal. A lot of people think this is just an amendment to the hardship withdrawal provisions? No, it's not. This is a brand new distribution provision. The equivalent is not in any plan anywhere until now. Although there were similar things back in the Katrina period as well, but that was temporary, as this is temporary. This is for plan year 2020, or for calendar, for the year 2020. A coronavirus-related distribution, or a CRD, says you can withdraw 100% of your investment account balance up to $100,000. It's for defined contribution plans and IRAs, as opposed to the two loan provisions that don't apply to IRAs, because you can't borrow money from an IRA. The flexibility of this is incredible. You can spread the tax over 3 years. There's no withholding. There's no 10% excise tax. Or at any time within the three-year period, you can roll over, roll back to the plan, roll to another plan, or roll to an IRA, part or all of the distribution, and get a refund for any taxes that you've paid. You can't add interest. Now, you don't have to add interest. In fact, you can't add interest, unlike a participant repayment, a loan repayment, where you have to add interest. So as Brad was saying, we ought to look at some of the differences. For example, most loans are a five-year payback. This is a three-year period. But this doesn't have interest. Loans have interest. Brad, why don't you pick up with where I just left off and run with that ball for a minute?
Yeah, because I think this is something plans need to make sure they've thought about. Because I think there's, prior to this, these new CARES Act provisions, I think generally people have said, geez, loans are better than hardship distributions because, you know, loans, there's a structured repayment. At least there's a chance the money goes back. And if the person ultimately defaults on the loan, well, it's essentially the same tax treatment as a distribution would have been. So why wouldn't you try to get this money repatriated? And that's one of the big questions here is, you know, how much are we damaging long-term retirement savings, granting there's a need for short-term emergency funds? Can we minimize that impact? But the way the tax treatment on these coronavirus distribution CRDs works is that it's very favorable. You get 3 years to realize the income instead of one. You waive the 10% early withdrawal penalty, and you still have 3 years to pay it back if you're going to. Now, granted, I think it's less likely a CRD is going to be paid back than a loan simply because loans have a structured repayment period. But you have to consider these loans could be actually quite significant. You know, Fred and I were talking about this the other day. If I borrowed $100,000 from my plan for this COVID-related loan and I start making payments next year because I don't have to make them this year, then I'm looking at, on a five-year loan, forgetting about interest, almost $1,700 a month in loan repayments. So there's a real risk of people defaulting on these loans the following year, in 2021 and beyond. And if that happens, the tax consequences are going to be pretty adverse. You're going to realize all that income as a deemed distribution in 1 year. If you're under 59.5, you're going to get the 10% penalty. So the COVID-related distribution provision has such unique tax consequences that I think plans really need to think about, do we want both of these provisions? Do we only want one of them? If we want loans, what's the risk of loan default? And are there actions we could take that would minimize some of those risks? And some of the things to also think about on these loan issues are who's eligible for a loan. If I've already laid off people and I don't specify that a separated vested employee can get a loan, will they be able to access these loans even if I make them available? And going back to the point before, does my record keeper allow separated vested employees to make loans, to originate loans? What about ongoing payments? If I later lay somebody off or they change jobs, typically that will result in many plans and a loan being due within a certain period of time. Is that something that we want to change in this, so that, and can our record keeper accommodate that change so that people can continue to make loan payments as separated vested participants who are no longer employees? There's a lot of moving parts to these loan provisions that plans really need to think about and decide if this is an approach that makes sense for their workers or not. The CRD provisions, I think, are pretty straightforward. The loan provisions, I think, are actually quite complex and something plans need to give some real thought to.
Yeah, I, you know, Brad is just trying to think of where the CRD would work really well. But if it were like a law firm that was having a really bad year, but they'll bounce back in the future, so the partners will be making good money and the associates will be back to being fully compensated, or a medical group, or maybe a small business, or something where people will come back and make pretty good income in the future, it's hard to beat the CRD for those guys. I mean, because they get the money now, they don't have to repay it for 3 years. At the end of 3 years, if they don't have enough to pay it all back, they'll be financially capable of getting a loan and paying the loan back for the part they can't pay back. I mean, there's so much flexibility there for people who have financial abilities in the future. Okay, shall we move on? Let me just say one thing about this. I think, you know, Brad was talking earlier about how plans are savings plans, or retirement plans, rather, and I mean, clearly that's true, but I'm beginning to think, you know, we had this in Katrina. We have hardship withdrawal provisions in plans. We have loan provision withdrawals in plans. We have this again now. Are we actually watching 401k plans morph into retirement and emergency plans rather than just being retirement plans? It's pretty hard to say we're not watching that happen, because between 2009-ish, 8-9, and now, a little over 10 years, it's the second time they've been used as emergency plans. And then, of course, there's been the hardship withdrawal and the loan provisions all the way along. So I think we may be seeing some change going on here that it's hard to identify in real time. So, Brad, shall I move on to RMDs?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. RMDs are different than the first three we talked about. The first three are how do you get money out of plans. This one is how do you leave money in plans and IRAs. What the CARES Act says is that the R&D provision is suspended for 2020, for calendar year 2020. That means that anybody that turned 70 and a half in 2019 and was planned on taking their distribution, their first distribution, on or before April 1, 2020, that got suspended, plus any RMDs that were otherwise due to be paid out this year. It's like I said, it's with plans at IRIS. It's not specific. It's not limited to plans. It's not limited to people with qualifying individuals, you know, CRD condition or coronavirus issues. So what is it? Well, you don't have to take the money out, and therefore it's not a required minimum distribution. There's a crazy rule, a set of rules, that says that a plan doesn't have to treat it as a regular distribution. For example, a plan doesn't have to give a 402F notice. It doesn't have to do the 20% withholding, on and on. So a plan can just treat it like a regular distribution. But the individual can treat it as a rollover distribution and can roll it over to an IRA if they want or back into the plan if the plan permits, if it's already been received. Otherwise, it can be suspended. The dilemma here, though, is what do you do? IRAs are pretty easy because the individual's in control. But what does a plan do? Well, a plan has three groups of employees that at first blush could be impacted by this. One is employees, rank-and-file employees, regular employees over 70 and a half still working at the company. Well, they're not really impacted because they don't have to take RMDs. Well, what about employees who have left but still have account balances, and they're over 70 and a half? Well, yes, sure, they are. They've got to make required minimum distributions to them except for this year's suspension. And then 5% or more owners, a so-called key employee, they're, even if they're still working and they're over 70 and a half, they have to take RMDs. So how does that all play out? Well, if I were a 5% owner, I probably wouldn't want it. So I'd probably want the company to say you don't have to take it. But if I were a rank-and-file employee, retired, over 70 and a half on an account balance, I need that money to live on. So I would want to take it. So there's a bit of a conflict there. And the easy way to resolve the conflict is to say our plan will automatically make distributions that otherwise would have been required minimum distributions, except that people can opt out if they don't want the distribution. That is how I think you can approach it, but obviously there are different ways of looking at it. So let me turn it over to Brad and see if he sees it differently.
Well, yeah, I think this is another case where we're going to have a number of scenarios that pop up. One issue is what do you do with a distribution that was already taken as an RMD in January? Can that be returned to the plan? And if so, what's the mechanism? There's a lot of these questions that presumably later guidance from Treasury and IRS are going to help us resolve. I think in the short term, Fred, to your point, that there are several ways this could be done, and what you're describing, I think, is one of the common ways people are looking at that. Again, talk to your platform provider, your record keeper, and figure out what they're recommending you do and how they are able to do it. Because, again, I'll go back to the point that what you want to do and what the law lets you do and whether the record keeper can do that could be three different things. And not all record keepers are reading these provisions the same way in their early implementation of it. So go back, talk to your record keeper, and make sure you know what's going on with your plan.
Yeah, one last tidbit, and we'll move on to securities issues. The IRS has issued a notice, 2020-23, that provides some relief for people who may have taken RMDs without knowing they could roll it over, thinking they had to take it earlier in the year. It's a crazy provision, though. It says if your 60-day rollover period expires on April 1 or later, you have until July 15th to complete the rollover. Well, what does that mean? Well, that's good for everybody except for people that got an RMD in January, because anything in February didn't expire through April 1 or later, but anything in January had already expired by the time you got to April 1. I don't know why they drafted the rule that way. It's crazy. But it is. That's the way it is. And so for people who took RMDs thinking they had to, on February, or where the 60-day period expires on April 1 or later, they can actually still roll over, even though we're beyond the end of the normal 60-day period. So, Brad, do you want to add anything to that, or shall I move on?
No, I don't think there's a whole lot more to say there. I mean, again, this falls into the category of we have some guidance, we're probably going to get some more, and we're having to just make some best guesses about how to proceed in the meantime on things that have to be addressed before that guidance comes out.
Yeah, I think there will be more guidance, almost certainly.
I will also say, I think both DOL and IRS have indicated that in various forms and to varying degrees of strength, so to speak, but they've all kind of indicated that there's going to be an acknowledgement on the enforcement side that people are having to make decisions and operate in unusual circumstances, and that good faith compliance efforts that are, you know, reasonably designed to do as much as we can to, you know, make participant notifications, et cetera, are going to be sort of considered as valid. So in other words, there's going to be some accommodation by the enforcement side of this down the road to recognize that if you're trying to do the right thing but you can't, or you make a good faith judgment that turns out to be different than down the road what the IRS may decide, there's probably going to be some leeway there, and they're probably not going to be punitive.
Yeah, I read it the same way, Brad. The only thing I would emphasize there is that good faith effort is three words, and the third word is effort. Good faith effort doesn't mean you get away with nothing.
That's a great point.
There's got to be an attempt. I don't want people to go to sleep on the words good faith and forget the word edit or effort. Hey, speaking of good faith, I want to have Sandy go next. And the SEC has issued two risk alerts that also deal with the coronavirus disruption. The one was a risk alert on the application of regulation best interest. The other was on form CRS. Both of these risk alerts came out after the SEC had said that they're not going to delay the June 30 implementation date for Reg BI or for form CRS. So, Sandy, take it away.
So you stole my segue, Fred, because I was going to use the good faith segue. But that's right. So on April 2nd, 2020, Chairman Clayton had said that they were sticking, the SEC was going to stick to the June 30th, 2020 compliance date for Reg BI. And then the next week, on April 7th, the Security and Exchange Office of Compliance, Inspection and Examination, OCIE, referred to as OC, issued those two risk alerts. So one of them had to do with its examination for firms' compliances with Reg BI, which I will discuss, and the second one had to do with its examination for firms' compliances with the CRS, which my partner Jim Lundy will discuss right after me. So with regard to the Reg BI alert, OC said it was providing, and this is a quote, OC is providing transparency into its plans regarding regulation best interest examinations to empower broker-dealers to assess their level of preparedness as the compliance date nears. And significantly attached to that particular risk alert was a three-page appendix, which had the documents listed relevant to the broker-dealers and how OC would review relevant documents to sort of assess whether broker-dealers were implementing the plan for Reg BI. So if you're in the area where you're looking to see or you're working on your preparedness for Reg BI, we highly recommend that you take a look at that appendix to see which documents apply to you and use that kind of as a roadmap. So the examinations are designed primarily to evaluate whether broker-dealers are establishing policies and procedures reasonably designed to achieve compliance with Reg BI. And once again, it's a good faith effort. So I just want to, as an aside to the good faith effort recommendation, SIFMA had a training seminar on Reg BI that took place earlier this week, and among the people on the panel were SEC representatives. And there was a discussion about whether, you know, broker-dealers who are now head down, pens up, working on their written supervisory provisions and thinking about the examinations, like talk to me in July about the examinations. Right now I'm focusing on perfecting my written supervisory provisions. The SEC response to that was all well and good, but remember, when we're looking for good faith compliance, it's not just whether you have policies and procedures that could, if implemented, result in compliance with Reg BI. You have to show as well that you're making good faith to implement those written procedures, and you are making good faith efforts to train your brokers so that the policies and procedures are in fact implemented. So keep that in mind if that's something that you're thinking about. The guidelines, the LC guidelines aligned to the Reg BI elements, which is disclosure obligations, the care obligations, and the conflict of interest obligation, and of course the compliance obligation. With regard to the disclosure obligation, it specifically says that it's going to look to the capacity in which recommendations are being made, the material fees and costs that apply to transactions, holdings and accounts, and material limitations on the securities or investment strategies. And it's looking to review documents that relate to a schedule of fees, charges assessed against retail customers, broker-dealers' compensation methods for registered personnel, including compensation associated with the recommendations to retail customers, the source and types of compensations, related conflicts of interest, and recommending proprietary products, disclosures related to monitoring retail customers' accounts, disclosures of material limitations on accounts or services, and lists of proprietary products sold to retail customers. The care obligation would also include review of information collected from retail customers to develop a broker's investment profile of that customer, the broker-dealer's process for having reasonable basis to believe a recommendation is in the best interest of the retail customer, and those factors would include things like assessing the potential risks, rewards, and costs, and the process of having a reasonable basis to believe that the recommended transaction is in the client's best interest, not that of the broker-dealer's. How the broker-dealer makes recommendations, including such things as recommendations for rollovers and account recommendations, how the broker-dealer makes recommendations related to more complex investment products. And as far as the conflict of interest, they're going to look to see how policies and procedures address those kinds of things, how conflicts that are created by incentives of the associated person and place the interest of the broker ahead of the interest of customers, conflicts associated with material limitations like product limits in the menu, limitations of sales contests, sales quotas, bonuses, non-cash compensations, how policies and procedures establish structures for identifying conflicts, identifying and assessing conflicts in the brokerage business as it evolves, how policies and procedures provide for disclosure of conflicts, and how the policies and procedures provide for mitigation or elimination of conflicts. And then as far as the care obligation, remember we talked about the fact that it has to be more than just a good faith effort to write the policy. Remember, they're going to actually look to see if you're implementing it. But they're looking to see if there are controls, remediation and noncompliance and training, policies and procedures that evaluate any controls, remediations of noncompliance and training and periodic review of the testing. So in total, I would say take a significant look at the OC's appendix in this particular risk alert. And just as an aside, FINRA had conducted, beginning in the fall, conducted a review of compliance efforts for a large, small, and medium-sized brokerage firms, and they reported their findings of that review recently, so that can be found on FINRA's website. They're not endorsing any of the methods that they saw, but I think it's significant that at least they're reporting it, so that's something to consider. So that covers the Reg BI risk alert, and I'm going to pass it to Jim Lundy to discuss the BRS risk alert. Jim?
Sure. Thank you, Sandy. Hello, everyone, and hope everyone's doing as well as possible during the times we find ourselves in. As Sandy said, the kickoff of these risk alerts was the April 2nd statement by Chairman Clayton, which was unusual in and of itself in that, the chairman issued a statement to say that the previously released compliance date for Reg BI and Form CRS was going to remain in place. And I think the buildup to that was because, obviously, with what was going on in the country and around the world, and the impact it was having on the financial services industry, we started to hear certain firms and certain industry groups begin to consider, through the comment letter process, approaching the commission about an extension. And I was on a call actually the week before the chairman's statement where that topic was being discussed and volunteered to assist with that effort. Before we could get that off the ground, though, the chairman issued this statement in which he specifically flagged that OC would be coming out with two risk alerts soon after his statement, and true to their word, at the SEC, after the April 2nd statement, the risk alerts were issued on April 7th, and in the interim, on April 6th, there was an FAQ issued with some points that I'll also cover regarding Form CRS. As Sandy said, featured prominently in the chairman's statement and in both risk alerts was this concept of good faith, that they'll be assessing whether there was a good faith effort to implement Form CRS processes, and as Sandy mentioned, policies, procedures, and processes regarding Reg BI. And I've had some clients ask me what that means, and so it they don't define it, but I know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that for firms who were taking the position that Reg BI and Form CRS may suffer the same fate as what ended up happening to aspects of the DOL fiduciary rule with the Fifth Circuit appellate ruling, and decided to kind of take a wait-and-see attitude, those firms are going to be challenged regarding their efforts, and they're going to have a difficult time establishing that they made a good faith effort to do that. And I say that without passing judgment, but that's an example of a situation that I think if firms find themselves in that position, it will be difficult to establish this good faith justification. But even then, for firms like that or for other firms that are thinking about how to prepare themselves to the extent they are looking forward and of the view that they may have to be on track for the June 30th compliance date, they should start thinking about a plan that they can have in place to support good faith efforts that they have engaged in. And I would recommend that firms think about being proactive in that regard when they begin to interact with the OC staff for these examinations. So turning to the risk alert, it was similar to the Reg BI one. Obviously, the topics are different. You know, one significant difference is they did not attach an appendix, which is a template document request for Reg BI that Sandy covered, and I'd echo what Sandy said. Firms should look really closely at that. Again, pretty unusual for the SEC to give firms a 2.5-month start on a document request by putting it out in the risk alert. They've never done that before through their risk alert processes, so that's helpful information for Reg BI. But unfortunately, we don't have that for CRS. But what we do have for CRS is an overview of the areas that they plan to examine, and those areas are delivery and filing, the content of the relationship summary itself, the formatting, a firm's policies and procedures regarding updating, and books and records. So prominently in this alert are the first two categories, which are discussed in greater detail. So I think it's a reasonable takeaway that may be a more significant area of the examination efforts after June 30th, and you may see an emphasis in the examination scope in those areas. And the first of those areas is delivery and filing, and more specifically what the risk alert advises is that OC will be reviewing whether the firm has obviously filed its relationship summary, including any amendments, and more importantly, evaluating the process for delivering their relationship summary to existing and new retail customers, and then reviewing the policies and procedures in that regard. Regarding the delivery, and for larger firms, obviously, this can become much more difficult due to size and complexity. But for delivery, the risk alert breaks it down to what OC will be assessing for existing versus new retail investors. And for the existing retail investors, they'll be looking at delivery and the initial delivery of the relationship summary to these existing retail investors by July 30th, 2020, and within 30 days after the date, the firm must file that with the commission as well. And that is going to be before or at the time of the opening of a new account, a recommendation of a rollover, or a recommendation of a new brokerage or investment advisory service thereafter. For new retail investors, the alert summarizes the requirements and what OC will be considering in terms of new retail investor delivery requirements occurring at the entering into an investment advisory contract with the retail investor, at the time a recommendation to a retail investor is made regarding an account type, a securities transaction, or an investment strategy, placing an order for a retail investor, or the opening of a brokerage account for a retail investor. In terms of timing, this is where the FAQ gets woven into this, because the FAQ addresses that, you know, for firms that are prepared, they can begin to deliver the Form CRS early, and they're welcome to do that. And I think it's fair to say that for firms that are ready, the FAQ is encouraging them to do that by posting the relationship summary on the website, complying with the updating and related delivery requirements that I just discussed, and then filing their form with the SEC via the appropriate methods. Turning to the relationship summary, OC then describes how it will be considering the content itself. And they break it down in terms of they'll be examining how the firm describes the relationships and services that it offers to the retail investors, how the firm describes its fees and costs. And I've had discussions with a lot of clients about that. I think the best practice will be the more detail, the better. The days of not being specific and, dare I say, being as granular as possible, I think those days are behind us. Any cost, whether it's direct or any fee, needs to be disclosed with specificity. And they specifically, the OCA risk alert specifically talks about indirect fees being disclosed with specificity. Compensation, obviously, due to financial incentives, we've all seen a lot in that regard regarding conflicts and disclosures regarding conflicts over the past few years. So OC will be assessing how the firm and the relationship summary describes the manner in which its financial professionals are compensated, and in turn how the firm describes not just those conflicts of interest but other conflicts of interest. You know, one thing we've been talking about with clients that have the resources to do so is to take a holistic view of conflicts and potential conflicts of interest, log them, track them, and rank them, in that if you can develop a methodology to do that, we're encouraging firms that have the resources to do that to begin a process like that. Some firms already started that, obviously, in considering those issues themselves, but we're hearing more and more about that. Not that OC is going to require that, but that is a way to kind of fend off OC in these types of areas where they're going to be assessing, you know, what the conflicts are, how they're graded, and how they're disclosed. And then, obviously, things such as disciplinary history and the accuracy of that is going to be another issue that OC will be assessing. The other substantive part of Form CRS that OC spends a little more time on is updates, and in particular, how and whether a firm updates and files its relationship summary within 30 days after information in the relationship summary becomes materially inaccurate. How and whether a firm communicates said changes to retail investors within 60 days after the updates are required, and how the firm's processes highlight for those retail investors those changes, including an exhibit highlighting or summarizing the material changes filed with any updates. The remaining two aspects regarding formatting and books and the record keeping are covered much more succinctly. The formatting guidance was pretty straightforward. But they will be assessing compliance with that, and then also record keeping, and that the Form CRS processes and documentation will be reflected and maintained in the firm's books and records. So that's an overview of the risk alert. Like Sandy said regarding the Reg DI risk alert, you know, we're encouraging all of our clients and contacts to read these risk alerts very, very closely. It is unique that OC is really kind of showing its hand on what its plans are for these examinations, but you know, we're in unique times, and with all the quarantine orders around the country, firms are operating virtually, and and operating in full with the full implementation of their business continuity plans. So, you know, this is the rare occasion where the SEC is really being proactive, and I think it's fair to say trying to be helpful and very transparent to firms about what their expectations are after June 30th. So firms really need to take a close look at these risk alerts, and as Sandy said, for the Reg BI risk alert, take a close look at that document request attached as Exhibit A. This is a really helpful tool for firms to see where they're at as we're moving forward and getting closer to that June 30th date. So that's all I had, Fred, and again, hope everyone's doing as well as possible.
Okay,
Fred, is that the SEC has said that it's still collecting, at least for the time being, questions through its FAQ inbox. So if firms have general questions that would be applicable to an FAQ, they can make the questions there, and if they don't, the SEC is asking that they either ask the questions through counsel, reach out through their examiner, or go the way of a no-action letter. And that's all I had for it.
Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you a couple quick questions, and then and do some of the pre-submitted questions, and we'll open it up. But to start with, you mentioned when the CRS becomes materially inaccurate, then it has to be updated and redistributed and filed. Jim, the question I'm getting is, how do you know if something is materially inaccurate? What should somebody make of that?
Yeah, the first answer is they're not going to tell you. In 600 pages in the final rule, they don't tell you what material inaccurate is. But, you know, it's one of these, you know it when you see it, and I'm not trying to be evasive about it, Fred, but firms who know their business, who know the disclosures that are important to their business, and know when there are changes to their business that in turn will require changes to a disclosure, they know what that materiality is. And so I think what firms need to do is be sensitive to it and develop a process that reflects that type of reasonable assessment. So, you know, what happened, what is the connection between business changes or any other changes that may impact disclosures in a form CRS? And how is that evaluated? And if it is determined to be material and it's determined to impact the accuracy of a disclosure, how is that disclosure going to be addressed? And that's the way I think firms need to be thinking about it, not what in fact is going to trigger whether it's material or not. That's the output of the decision-making process. The important thing is to have a process in place and a documented process that reflects a reasonable and thoughtful approach to potential material inaccuracies. And then when you assess those potential material inaccuracies, you get an outcome with the understanding of your business and with what the historical disclosures are that will allow you to make a reasonable decision regarding whether or not you do in fact have that material inaccuracy that triggers the requirement to make the change.
Okay, one more question like that. Give me a really quick answer. Another word that's undefined is prominent. For example, it says that the CRS has to be displayed prominently on the firm's website. What's the difference between prominent and just being there?
Yeah, so I believe that question came in ahead of time, Fred, and I went back and read the rule and then looked specifically for the word prominent. And again, in hundreds and hundreds of pages, and it is done purposefully, the SEC does not define that. And it doesn't define it because firms come in all shapes and sizes. Firms use different tools to present themselves to the public and to their clients. They use different types of websites with different type of content and different types of complexity on those websites. So in addition to being, you know, principles-based approach to their rulemaking, in particular these rules, I think the SEC probably had a concern about being too prescriptive, that type of guidance. So I looked at the Fagery Drinker website, and we have a section that's called Featured Content, Trending Topics, and News and Insights. Those seem to be, to me, prominent links on our main website. So I think if I'm thinking of what would be a prominent way to disclose, if we had to, a Fagery Drinker form CRS, it should be featured in the same way as those areas that I just mentioned. It shouldn't be featured where we list all of our locations at the very bottom of the page in a way that I think comparatively I can objectively say is not as prominent as the other things I just mentioned. So again, it needs to be reasonable and thoughtful. To the extent there's an issue, the decision should probably be documented so that if challenged, you can present to the staff a contemporaneous document reflecting a process where you evaluated prominence and came to the right decision.
Okay, good. Yeah, I know in other places where governmental agencies have imposed similar standards, they've said highlight it or make it bolder or bigger letters, somehow different than the rest of the content on the page, make it stand out in some way. But I'm not sure.
I want to be careful. It doesn't say that.
No, it doesn't say that. I'm just saying that other guidance issued by other agencies have taken that sort of a position that would be a way to be prominent, which I think by the dictionary definition means somewhat like above the others.
I think this is why it's difficult for everyone to define it, because reasonable minds can disagree. I think it's not necessarily saying that Form CRS needs to be the most prominent thing on a firm's website. So, again, reasonable minds may disagree. I think what is fair to say is if you do a comparison of things on your website, there are going to be things that are more visible and more prominent and more available via the website higher up on the page or with different lettering, more in bold. I think it's fair to say that Form CRS would fall into that type of a category. But I would stop short of saying it has to be the most prominent thing on your website. I did not see anything in the rule that said that.
Yeah, no, I wasn't trying to say that either. I think it has to be one of the prominent things. Sandy, let me turn to you. On the call with the SEC representatives, did they touch on mitigation of conflicts of the financial advisors or of the registered representatives of the broker-dealers?
I don't recall them specifically addressing that issue. I mean, they often deferred back to the FAQs, and they're unwilling to say anything they haven't already put in writing. So I would suggest that the SEC's FAQs on Reg BI would be the place to address that, or to see if there's some discussion about what would be an appropriate mitigation, that they weren't giving specifics on this particular call.
Okay. Brad, is there any, what's up in terms of regulations and the like from the Department of Labor?
Yeah, so there's kind of three things people are most talking about in terms of the Department of Labor's regulatory agenda for our area. First of all, we're anticipating the spring unified regulatory agenda to come out here pretty soon. And that's the document they put out every 6 months out of the Office of Management and Budget that says exactly, what regulations they're working on and a proposed timetable for the next step in the regulatory process. So, for example, what just happened recently, and we haven't got that yet, so when we get that, we'll have a better idea of how they're prioritizing some of the rules. What just happened about 2 weeks ago is the Labor Department sent to the White House for review the final regulation on electronic disclosure. So they've clearly prioritized that regulation over the proposed fiduciary rule 2.0 regulation, because that has not yet gone to the White House for review. Exactly where that new fiduciary rule proposal is going to fall, we probably won't get a good sense until we see this new regulatory agenda that tells us that it's there. What we've heard consistently for the last 6 or 8 months is that DOL has been working on the fiduciary rule, and it could come out very soon, but that hasn't happened. And obviously, with the coronavirus and everything else going on, there's a lot of new demands on the department's attention. But despite those new demands, they decided to move the final electronic disclosure rule first. So we're waiting for that to be published in the Federal Register. It went to the White House roughly mid-April. That process for White House review can take up to 90 days, although typically in this administration they move things a little faster than that. So probably in the next 2 months we'll see a published final rule on electronic disclosure. Obviously, in the meantime, DOE will put out some guidance for the coronavirus that gives us effectively electronic disclosure already for communication sort of through the duration of this emergency. But that's a temporary measure. This would be the final rule for electronic disclosure that had been proposed last year. The other big thing, of course, is that Preston Rutledge, the Assistant Secretary at EBSA, has announced that he's going to be leaving at the end of next month. And we don't know what the administration's plans might be for a long-term replacement, but in the short term, obviously, his deputy, Gene Wilson, will take over as the acting assistant secretary, and I think everyone on this call knows her well, and wishes Preston well, and I think he was widely respected by everybody on all sides of these issues, and I think Gene is as well, and so that transition shouldn't result in any significant changes in terms of the department's ability to meet its deadlines or otherwise do its work. The other big rule we're waiting on for DOL, which we don't anticipate seeing anytime soon, but the regulatory agenda might tell us something interesting, is what they're going to do on the lifetime annuity projection that needs to be on a participant's benefit statement. That's a new requirement of the SECURE Act. The law gave DOL the ability to use an interim final regulation, which is an expedited regulatory process where they don't have to put out a proposal before the rule goes into effect. But they have to issue that within 12 months, which would be by this December. That was always very ambitious because it's a difficult rule, and I think given the coronavirus and given the presidential election and everything else that's going on, it might be difficult for DOL to meet that deadline. Last observation I'll make on the reg agenda is that this is a presidential election year, and obviously if President Trump is reelected, then the things likely will continue on more or less the same track they are. If President Biden wins, that will likely result in more or less a lockdown of the regulatory process for several months while the incoming administration figures out what to do. So on top of the uncertainty from the coronavirus, we have election uncertainty. So at the end of the day, everyone's guess is as good as anyone else's as to what will actually happen when.
Fred, operator, we can take a minute or two just to answer a couple of questions. So would you open up the lines, operator?
Fred, can I interject while the lines are being opened up? So I just took a look at the FAQs, and as we suspected, the SEC says that it's not mandating any specific mitigation measures, but rather permitting the firms to the flexibility to make reasonable design policies to meet their particular circumstances.
Okay, thank you, Sandy. Operator?
And we do have a caller in queue. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Rita Hagedorn from Arkema. I had a question about safe harbor notices. Would a safe harbor notice be required at the point in which you make the change to provide the loan option in your 401k plan?
You know, I haven't seen anything specifically on that. Brad, have you?
Yeah, I think the answer is no. There isn't a specific notice associated with either of the new distribution or coronavirus distribution or loan provisions. I think what in practice we're seeing is that notice is being sent as soon as people can figure out how to do it most readily, often by email, and that the DOL announcement from yesterday facilitating email communications should help that. So I think what you'll find is most record keepers are sending notices or suggesting the plans do so, even if there may not be a binding formal requirement.
Okay. Yeah, basically what we're doing is working with our record keeper to send that information, but not, and the question really was more of a, do we need a formal safe harbor notice? So there's not really any requirement in that regard.
Well, in terms of if you're saying you want to adopt the coronavirus loan provisions in your plan?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there isn't a specific notice, but realistically, we would agree you should provide a notice, and you know, work with your record keeper on a means to do that as soon as sort of reasonably practicable. But there isn't a formal requirement that's clearly established by the CARES Act. And I think, you know, given the urgent nature of these communications, worrying about some of the niceties, this is where I think we're falling into that sort of good faith effort area, where you probably should do a notice, whether it's technically required or not. Are you running afoul of a rule of not providing it on a certain time frame? It's probably less important than trying to do things that actually help your participants operate their mm-hmm. rights and obligations under the plan.
Yeah, picking up on where Brad left off, yesterday the Department of Labor issued three documents, a set of facts and some guidance, where they're basically taking a good faith approach. That guidance mentions notices. I did not look at it from the perspective of your question, but you may want to go back and look at the guidance that the department issued yesterday and see if there's some relief in there. I think you're saying you have a safe harbor plan and you want to know if you have to issue a notice because you're amending it. Is that the question?
Yes.
Or is that, did Brad hit it?
That's the question. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think there's been any guidance on that. And I would rely, I mean, I think the good faith guidance issued yesterday might have your answer in there, but I can't tell you what it would be right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Operator, one more question, and then we'll call it a day. Okay. Operator, since there's no more questions, let me turn it over to Jim to wrap up the program, and thanks, everybody.
Certainly, Fred, thanks so much. Great call today. Thanks again, everyone, for calling in. And thank you to, again, Fred, Brad, Sandy, and Jim for their perspective. Please mark your calendars for July 30th. That's our next scheduled call. And please hope everyone stays safe and healthy. Thanks so much. Operator, you may close out the call.